that is in the bulk of the interstellar medium, and in most of the time, dissipation seems to be taking place in vortices. So I'm going to show you the few observational evidence that we have of that. And just to start with, because the interstellar medium is very different from the medium, the gas which had been discussed last week at the conference. Well, I wanted a pointer, but I don't need one. Okay. Okay, I took it. Okay, thank you. Okay. So I'm going to discuss two mediums in the cone, neutral medium. The one which is diluted with only 20 particles per cubic centimeter, and molecular clouds which are much denser. In both cases, the ionization degree, which is carried here by the C plus ions and here by this HCO plus ion, is low enough that the medium is well coupled to the magnetic field at long time scales over between 10 to the 4th and 10 to the 6th years, while at very short time scales, which is the time scale for ion neutral collisions, the ion neutral frictions are highly dissipative. So we have a medium which is partially coupled to the magnetic field, and I took this magnetic field intensity for the dense and diffuse gas. The Alvin velocities are here, and as a result, the shocks which form in those gas media are continuous shocks. They are mediated by a magnetic precursor which puts the neutrals into motion, and the velocity discontinuities are suppressed. So these shocks, these C shocks, are very big structures, large structures in the gas. And they have been modeled by Pino de Forest and co-workers, and McLaw and Drain. So there is a specialist of that in the room. But this is the typical size scale thickness of the shocks. We have tried to model what would be vortices generated by turbulence in a medium where the magnetic field is so present. So we have done that we don't have an ideal solution, but we started with the Burgers vortex, which is a solution of the Helmholtz equation, and we used the work done by Moffat, Frida, and Okitani in 1994, where they said that the vortices are the sinews of turbulence. So that is to say that without these sinews, the turbulence would not work at all. So the distribution of the vorticity in the Burgers vortex is Gaussian, and it results from a balance between the diffusion of vorticity and the strain rate, A, which is due to the large-scale motion. So we took this solution and we added magnetic field. But we also wanted to take into account that the vortices are of finite length. So we started with a colloidal field parallel to the vorticity. And the fact that the vortex is of, we took, I don't remember, but 10 to 100 times the radius for the length, introduces a dependence with D, which is along the vortex of the rotational velocity of the neutral in the vortex. And this generates a toroidal field of small amplitude compared to BZ, but which allows a drift velocity between the neutral and the ions. So we have computed the steady-state solution with this approximation, which gives us a dependence with the radius and the z direction along the main field of the drift velocity and the viscous dissipation due to neutral-neutral collisions, which are the two main dissipative processes in this structure. Yes, indeed, the Lorentz force balances the ion-neutral friction.
No, but the structure of the vortex, Say just the solution for a vortex.
Yes, it's a since we cannot describe the large scales, we have taken the Burgers vortex and we have truncated it, so it's no longer the Burgers solution. So mathematically, it's not correct. But the Z dependence is weak compared to the radial dependencies.
So you can understand, you have this vortex going around, but it's a finite length.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't have any slippage between the neutrals and the ions,
we would not have friction.
The field lines would wind up.
Yes.
Right, but it's wound up only just a little bit because the embed is much
higher than
BZ.
I could draw.
And in addition, the field lines balances the drag.
Yes. In the theta direction.
Meridian plane.
Yes. Okay. No, it is in the theta direction.
Yeah, that's the toroidal.
Yes.
That's what the other meant. The component of these sides.
Oh, in the poloidal direction, we neglect it. So this is the structure which has been computed. And what is remarkable, so this is the run of the vorticity. With the radius, so here is the radius in centimeter, and the size scales are much smaller than the size scales of the C-shocks I showed before. Here is 10 AU. So the vorticity is Gaussian. Here is the run of the drift velocity, so the difference between the neutral and ion velocity with the radius. It has a peak, which is located at about 10 AU from the axis of the vortex. This is the run of the heating rate due to neutral-neutral collisions in the regions where the shear is maximum at the boundary of the vortex. And as a result, this drift velocity between the ions and this viscous dissipation rate in the neutral component give rise to allow the temperature to rise up to 1,000 K, while the surrounding gas is at 50 K, 100. Oh yes, we have a thermal balance. Well, it's not thermal balance. We write that the temperature evolution as the gas enters spirals in the vortex follows the heating rate minus cooling. We have a real cooling computation.
So there's a radial flow.
Oh yes,
well.
yes. It enters in the vortex, Burgers vortex. There is a radial flow and the Z flow.
So the third graph does not depend on the magnetic field of the plasma
drift. No. It just depends on the shear at the edge of the vortex. Yes.
Yeah.
So
what about the
ion-neutral
rate? It is taken into account. These two processes contribute to this. The heating rate due to ion-neutral friction is 10% of that heating rate, which is neutral-neutral.
So that's actual neutral-neutral microscopic?
Viscous, yes. Elastic collisions, HH.
That's very large.
Yes. It's because the vortices are so small and so intense.
But it's bigger than the ion neutral.
Yes.
More neutrals.
Yes.
How did you get alpha? How did you get that constant?
Oh, that we use the experimental results which have allowed to measure the vorticity of coherent vortices in ambient flows, and they find are results quoted by Jimenez. They find that the rotational velocity of these coherent vortices is typically of the order of the RMS velocity of the ambient, well, the embedding turbulence.
So we have the RMS velocity of the embedding medium, which is 3.5 kilometers per second. So we put this constraint in the model. It may not be correct, but it gives an order of magnitude. And apparently people who do numerical simulations of that also find this result. So the main difference, I want to draw your attention to the fact that the time here, which is spent between this position here and more central position when the particle, the cell, gas cell spirals in, are very short, only a few hundred years. So the main differences between MHD shocks in the cold neutral medium, the diffused one, are here. So the size scales between MHD C shocks and vortices are very different, a factor of 2000. The crossing time scales are also very different, a few hundred years, while here it is 10 to the fourth year. There is slight compression in the shocks, while there is no compression in the vortices. The heating in the shocks is mostly ion neutral friction, while here it's mostly viscous dissipation in the shear layer around the vortex. Because, well, there are planar shocks, so there is no shear and no viscosity and no dissipation due to friction, neutral friction. It's mostly the friction due to the magnetic precursor which dissipates energy in these shocks.
I have a question. So you sort of set the scale for the vortex such that the neutral dissipation will be. But if you go to a larger scale where it's unimportant, what fraction of the relevant vorticity would you lose by trying to get down to the small scale?
Oh, yes. So I jumped over something. I didn't want to enter in detail. I have no time to do that. But the reason why we started to do that is that because in the interstellar medium, the cold medium, there are lots of molecules which are observed, like CH+, HCO+, OH, which cannot be formed in the cold gas. And these molecules carry signatures of cold gas, kinematic signatures of cold gas. So we thought, and many other people have tried to form these molecules in shocks, and we thought that, and unfortunately, the kinematic signatures of the shocks are not carried by these molecular lines. And we thought that a process which would be interesting would be something which would put together the viscous dissipation and the ion neutral friction into very small regions along in the medium so that all the kinematic effects could be averaged and not be visible. So we were interested in having very small structures.
But if you make them, I mean, it seems like if you have a vortex of comparable size to the heat shock, you'll have a
viscous dissipation.
If you look on a comparable scale in terms of the velocity gradient over a certain physical scale, it seems like you would have comparable heating from the ion neutral.
No, but on a larger volume, so the rise in temperature will be smaller. We need to get to 1,000 kg from this molecule. So we had constraints because we computed the chemistry in these things. And if we heat if the temperature does not rise very much, it does not do anything. So here is the number density of these shocks and the vortices that we need to reproduce the observed molecules like CH, HCO+, and so on. And we need typically 1,000 vortices each time we cross this quantity of matter in the interstellar medium. And much less shocks because they are thicker structures. And this corresponds to only a very small amount of mass of the cold interstellar medium, which should be raised at 1,000 K. Only 3% for the shocks and less than 1% for the vortices. So I wanted I wanted to show the observational signature of that. So the sea shocks and the vortices both are local heating sources for the gas, and with temperatures which are much above the average temperature of the medium. So they induce a hot chemistry in the cold gas. I will not discuss that. I just mentioned what that we did. They affect the collisional excitation of atoms and molecules, and we observe that, so we can derive that there is a fraction of hot gas on any line of sight. And they also change the ortho to power ratio of H2, which has an activation barrier of several thousand K. But these are common signatures for the two mechanisms for the dissipation.
Do the electrons get heated?
Yeah, but we assume that it's the same temperature as the ions.
Can you justify that? Is the time to keep the electrons short in terms of life of the bouquet?
Yes, but it's quite a complicated issue. It's an assumption, but it should be worked out for sure.
The electron is 60 times smaller than the iron absorption time.
That's right. But the temperature is 1,000 Kelvin. So, for 10,000 Kelvin, gets you above 1. The meaning part is electron or ion is about a tenth of an AU. So the temperature is down by a factor 10. So it's 1/100 of an AU. The density will help it even further. Okay, so you're down by some 1/1000 of an AU. Of course, you have to multiply it by this factor 1000, the mass ratio.
Uh-huh.
So it's comparable. It's about an AU.
The mean free path of the neutrons is about an AU also. So we are very close to not having the hydrodynamic assumptions correct, because the cells that we follow in a Lagrangian way as it enters the vortex is barely bigger than the mean free path of particles. So I would like to present you a few of the signatures which are specific to vortices. Yes.
So is this an incompressible vortex?
No. Except that the gas which is heated by the dissipation is supposed to expand. That the expansion time is longer than the lifetime of the vortex. So we didn't follow the dynamical evolution of the vortex. And when we computed the chemistry, we followed the thermal, the chemical evolution of the cell, but not the pressure. It's a very preliminary work, because there are many things which we don't know how to treat. So the signatures which are specific to the vortices rely on the fact that the vortex crossing time is so much smaller than the sea shock crossing times. That is, the structures are very different in size. And I will show you what is related to the fact that probably we see excited levels for H2 which are out of statistical equilibrium. The gas is out of thermal and chemical balance, that I will not show. That we have non-thermal ortho to power ratio, which I have shown it at the conference, but I can come back very rapidly on that. And there are also chemical signatures like the ratio of C2H on HCO+, which rely on the fact that chemical reactions have very different reaction times. And so the abundance of some molecules or ions may be very different in shocks and in vortices because of the time scales. But this is so much model dependent and relies so much on the cross section for chemical reactions that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I will present direct kinematics.
Sorry, aren't these also true? I mean, I agree the vortex crossing time is much less than the T-shot crossing time, but they're both much less than the chemical equilibration time.
Oh, yes.
That depends on the molecular hydrogen reformation time and equilibration time, which is quite long. Uh-huh. All this. So I'm not sure why these would not be also true for the T-shots.
Oh, no, you mean, are you mentioning octotopara?
No, I mean the excited levels are statistical equilibrium.
Oh, it's just a matter of excitation collisional time for excitation of levels of H2. I will show you, but I have already shown it, but I will come back on that. So the observations I presented during the conference were observations of H2 pure rotational lines that we made in the direction across the galaxy, which samples 20 magnitudes of gas, and in a direction which is devoid of star-forming regions and supernovae and things which generate turbulence in the medium. And we were interested in just testing the excitation conditions on the gas in very ordinary gas in the galaxy. So these are the detections. These are ISO measurements with the short wavelength spectrometer. And these are two of the three lines that we detected. They are among the weakest which have been detected by this instrument. So this is the G equal 3, well, yes, 3 to 1 line. The upper level is at 1,000 K. And this is the G equal 5 to 3 line here. And the upper level is at 2503 K.
Well, what's
H2. So this is the spectrum plotted versus the quantum rotational number of the upper level, and this is the specific intensity. So we have two upper limits for the S0 and the S4 line, and three detections with very narrowed error bars. And this is the emission which we compute would be attributed to the ambient medium just heated by UV photons in the galaxy. And this is the emission and computed for the small PDR, which is on the line of sight. It's not a very active, there is very little free emission. So what you can see is that if the intensity of the S0 line could be explained by the diffuse gas heated by at normal temperature, these three line intensities are more than one order of magnitude above what we would expect from the cold medium.
Excuse me, G0 is the ambient.
It is a
field, right?
Yes, yes.
And so you compute that for 10 times and 100 times. And,
yes, because it's we don't know. There is something like a B star just from the free emission somewhere on the line of sight. And we don't know at which distance of the molecular gas this star is. That's all. So with the shocks, so we assume that there are a number of T shocks on the line of sight. So these are the spectra which correspond to what we would expect for these numbers of T shocks. This is the shock velocity, 8, 10, and 14 kilometers per second. 20 corresponds to the length across the medium which is sampled, 20 magnitude of gas. And this number, 176 and 1, is the number of such shocks which is requested to produce the chemistry which is observed. The numbers I gave you in a previous view graph. So you see that the low velocity shocks would not have a spectrum very inconsistent with what is observed, but we need so many of them that the average intensity, well, the spectrum is far too high.
But do you mean, so those numbers are such that you reach the what are you matching them, the temperature?
No, the chemistry.
Since I didn't want to spend too much time, we know from the lots of observations in absorption against nearby stars or against the extragalactic continuum sources, what is the amount of molecules like OH, CH+, HCO+, carbon that we need, that we observe per magnitude of gas sampled. So there is a sort of calibration of all these dissipative processes. And we know that typically these shocks of at 8 kilometers per second should be, we should have 170 of them scattered on the line of sight in the medium to produce the molecules which we observe.
Do you mean to produce the
H plus one?
To produce the correct amount.
Column
density,
yes.
Amount?
Yes.
So, but what goes into that? You mean a certain temperature and,
yes.
and mass?
Yes, so we need typically 3% of the gas at 1,000 K. It's very, since these molecules are formed through endothermic reactions or reactions with activation barriers which are several thousand K, it's a very sharp threshold. You can say, well, I can drop the temperature to 500 K and I will form. So it's very sharp. And yes, this velocity is far too below 8 kilometers per second. We can't, it does not work.
So you have to be at least 8 kilometers.
Yes, yes.
Well, it doesn't work with smooth one-dimensional C shock.
Oh, yes.
C shock too heavy.
Okay, we will discuss that. Well, these are planar shocks.
Yeah.
You? 5 minutes. Oh, yes, thank you. Okay. And here, you see that the ortho and para lines are very different intensity because the ortho to para ratio in C shocks is free. It's the thermal value in at 1,000 K. And this is the same the result we got from the vortices. So we have the emission which would be due to 1,000 vortex multiplied by 20 for the magnitude, which is in the dotted line. It fits much more the spectrum because the ortho to para ratio there is only 1 because the time scale for crossing the vortices is so short that the thermal value of this ortho to para ratio has no time to be reached. And this is the dashed line here corresponds to the spectrum which we obtain when we assume that the H2 levels are out of statistical equilibrium. So we need more of them, 2300 per magnitude, but the shape of the spectrum is better in comparison to the observation. So it's a small effect, and we are planning to look further into that because it's a good test. The only few other things I wanted to just to show you another example of how we trace vorticity in the medium, and this is in a molecular clown. So these are maps of CO emission in different velocity beams, just to see you that there is a lot of structure. And I'm going to discuss this region here, this structure here. So when one builds probability distribution functions of line centering increments between two different positions across the map, we obtain this sort of PDF functions, which when you reduce the lag, which is written here, 6 to 3, non-Gaussian tails appear in the probability distribution functions. At large lag, the distributions are almost Gaussian. So we are interested in knowing what are the positions and what are the processes which populate these tails, non-Gaussian tails. In numerical simulations,
we showed a few years ago that the regions where these tails are non-Gaussians trace the so it's a work that we did with directly and Jérôme Petit. This is the distribution. These are numerical simulation of Porter, Pouquet, and Woodward of compressible, but slightly compressible turbulence.
Is this 3D?
3D, yes. It's 512 cube. So this is the distribution of this partial of this arrangement of two components of the average vorticity. And if we plot on that the regions where the tails of the line centroid increments, which are the things which we can observe, are non-Gaussian, the coincidence is very striking. So we think that when we plot the regions where the tails depart from Gaussianity, we measure vorticity. So this is in the field I showed you before, the regions in yellow, where the vorticity, well, the tails depart significantly from Gaussianity. So these are the non-Gaussian tails. And now I'm going to show you, in a field like that, observations which have been done at the plateau, with the Plateau de Bure interferometer. And I show you what is the small-scale structure of this. So it's 12C again. So it's complicated. I have this in three pieces. So these again are channel maps. So the resolution is about 3 arc seconds, which correspond to 500 AU. It's much larger resolution than the size of the vortices that I discussed previously. There is a lot, so the velocity changes from one panel to another, and you see that there are structures, and so this one corresponds to that.
What is the velocity width?
The 0.5 kilometers per second. No, 0.1. So this thing here.
If you
want
to use two, I can order
another.
Just to shift, just turn it on.
No, but I'm not sure that.
Oh, no, not one.
Okay, it's just for you to follow.
Shift it over. Go.
So, this thing, the coordinates are not the same, but this is astrophysics, real astrophysics. So, this is that. And so I show you this structure in another channel. Here. In another channel, here, at minus 49. And so I drew here the contours of this one. And I superpose it on the other one. So this is just to tell you that this which appears as a tail, the positions where the tail of the PDF of the line centroid increment is non-Gaussian correspond to this structure which appears at minus 1.5 kilometer per second here and minus 4.9 kilometer per second, and they are very adjacent and dynamically related with a velocity difference of 3.5 kilometer per second across 500 AU. It's a very intense vortex, and I don't show you, but there is no gas at intermediate velocity in this direction. There is no intermediate velocity.
Why do we say that this is a vortex instead of a shock that goes to a sudden jump?
Because there is no intermediate velocity. I can show you all.
But that's the point. In a shock front, you would expect the immediate velocity to be very energy. If there is a vortex, I would expect a certain sine theta.
Yeah, but there is a special. So, well, we are actually working on that, and we are working on chemical signature, and it we have found chemical signatures which sign more the vortices than the shocks in terms of velocity distribution again. So this vortex, if it is a vortex, is much bigger than what we would expect from the Burgers model. But it might be that it's a bunch of smaller vortices braided together, as is shown in numerical simulations. Vortices are not isolated, but they are grouped. And so this is my conclusion. I would tend to say that in the call I send, the main difference between C-shocks and vortices is due to their size scale and crossing time, and we are perhaps starting to see non-equilibrium processes in the thermal evolution, in the chemical evolution, and also the level population. And I have a question which maybe you will answer, Norman, which is the time scale for vortex formation longer than for shocks? And in that case, it has implications on the dissipation rate of supersonic turbulence and, of course, therefore, on the star formation rate. And I also wanted to note that the vortex signatures which we see don't seem to be mixed with those of shocks, as if shocks which have given rise to the vortices had already disappeared. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I have two questions. First of all, for the observation, if we're looking at such a large vortex, does that actually put us back into the same time scale as the C shocks?
Oh, yes. But what we don't know yet, but we think that it cannot be a single vortex. It has to be an ensemble of a large.
The point is that the velocity difference is over a large scale.
Well, 500 AU is much smaller than 20,000 AU.
But it's much larger than
Ten, yes. So it's
okay.
Intermediate.
The second point is more of a comment, which is that Julia Zulev, working with me and Michael Smith, actually directly measured in our simulations driven into gain turbulence the dissipation rate in shock compared to the total dissipation rate in volume, and found that the I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was approximately roughly equal. That we had as much shock as
usually between something like 30 and 60.
Exactly.
You mean the dissipation in the shocks and in the vortices?
Yeah.
Well, the dissipation in shocks in this type of curve you measure directly from the artificial shock,
exactly.
And the other terms are not directly resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But you can figure that's the
energy.
Grossly speaking, the reason why we have mixed, we have conceived this idea of taking a vortex is that the shocks regarding the chemistry are too much driven by, the dissipation is too much driven in shocks by ion neutral friction, and they have too little viscous neutral dissipation. And this has consequences on the chemistry, which whether you consider ion molecules reactions or neutral reactions. So we needed to speed up a little the neutral.
I'll make one more comment,
yeah.
My last one, I promise, which is that the Brandenburg and Zweibel singularities will produce current shapes that ought to heat up significantly and maybe a final form.
Oh, yeah, we have not worked very properly the magnetic solution of the Burgers partite.
Well, I was going to ask that same sort of question, because the mechanism that gives you a concentrated vortex will also tend to give you a concentrated flux tube of magnetic field. Is there any evidence at all from the observation that the field FDZ is also
more intense. No, that
it's hard to look.
That is very hard. No, but we will, I would like. Yes.
You mentioned this striking agreement between the locations where the departures from Gauss got from a Gaussian distribution, but that wasn't on a plot where you actually showed the vorticity itself, or which structures from the code did you actually show that?
Oh, it's from the code, yes.
Yes, and what was the vorticity, right?
Yes.
So obviously, whenever the vorticity is large, you end the tails.
Oh yes, but it's it shows that it's.
So it must agree, therefore, in whatever. When you have a dark area, that means what is this large?
They took the tail, the region distributed to the non-Gaussian tail and the y-axis velocity centroid, and correlated that.
There is no threshold applied on the vorticity. It's just the component of the vorticity which we can measure. Because we cannot measure the component which is there. Yes.
No,
I didn't order any.
The last number was
one RMS.
But look, no,
the came out of a spontaneous conversation.
What would be?
I'm standing in